Welcome to the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, talking about a little bit of femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. Hello, listeners. This is Risa E. Lewis, host for the Feminine Podcast. Today, I have a guest. Her name is Dr. Jo Shapiro. Jo, welcome.
Thank you, Risa.
So, listeners, I would say that in general, when I put my programming together and I think of topics, I think of themes. So, thematically speaking, last summer, I did a whole series on women for whom emergency medicine had played a role in their life, but now they're working on a new chapter, and emergency medicine launched them into that chapter. I did a series on women who are really making the mark and developing emergency medicine across Africa in all different countries. Today's program falls under the theme of professional development. The reason being is the role that Jo has played as part of her professional life. Before we jump ahead, I'm going to ask Jo, tell the listeners about yourself.
I am a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm an otolaryngologist. And I think you invited me to have this conversation with you, which I think, by the way, is really important conversation to have because of some of my leadership roles and involvement, both locally and nationally, around the topic of workplace environment. I developed and directed the Center for Professionalism and Peer Support at the Brigham, and led that for about 10 years. And prior to that, I had some other leadership roles, including one of the directors, associate director of graduate medical education for Mass General and Brigham. And then I also was division chief in otolaryngology at the Brigham. So I had some, have had different leadership roles, but most recently, this Center for Professionalism and Peer Support.
And are you a lifelong Bostonian?
No, I'm a New Yorker, although I've been in Boston for much longer than I've been in New York. So I grew up in New York, and I went to Cornell undergraduate and in New York. And then we used to have to do 2 years of general surgery, so I did those out in California, and then came back to do my residency in otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at the Harvard Combined Program. And then I ended up staying on faculty, and I've been on faculty at the Brigham since then, which is over 30 years.
Truth be told, I wanted to be an otorhinolaryngologist. When I was going through med school, I thought I was going to be a surgeon. And then I took a detour when I did a rotation in emergency medicine, and it just felt like a really, really good fit. That being said, I have lots of respect and continue to support and amplify any woman that selects surgery, and especially someone who did it during a time that perhaps there weren't many women going into surgery. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes, that is accurate. It absolutely is. I will say that I just love my specialty. It's one of those joys that I did figure this out to be a good match. And I love taking care of patients in the clinic, but I also love operating. So it's a really, it's a wonderful combination of both of those aspects of clinical care.
Great. So we're going to pivot. And, you know, I actually love words and I love reading. Actually, listeners, you won't be surprised that Jo loves reading too. But one of the words I've been using a lot these days is pivot. So today's program is not about otorhinolaryngology or otolaryngology. We're going to discuss professionalism. When I was in Colorado, I first became aware of an office of professionalism, and I had never heard of this before. And the person with whom I was speaking was saying that he had been in Ombuds and in the Ombuds office, which is another fun word, and he had decided to move from the Ombuds office to the office of professionalism. Now, I had no idea what either really did. I had not had encounters or interventions or meetings of any sort, but it got me thinking, and he told me about this woman in Boston named Jo Shapiro. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to connect with her and I'd love to hear more about what she does. So question for you, Jo. What is an ombuds? What would be a person that works in the ombudsman office versus an office of professionalism? And if I can add a third category, and then you can take this wherever it feels natural, how would that complement and be different from a Title IX office?
Yeah, important questions, because they are actually all different. So an ombudsperson is somebody who appointed essentially to listen to concerns. And for example, I'll give you locally, our ombudsperson works for Harvard Medical School. So she is there. She's fantastic, Melissa Broderick. So she is there. She will hear concerns about anything anybody has to say. She most often listens to concerns around authorship, those sorts of things. Because she's not employed by the people who work in the hospitals, and we're all part of Harvard Medical School, but we also work, you know, we are in the Harvard teaching hospitals, she is not obligated at all to share any of that information. In fact, she can keep anything reported to her completely confidential. So that's a wonderful role, that you can go to her and get advice about anything, and no question of her having to say to somebody else, oh, so-and-so reported this to me.
Even if she feels someone is in danger, or there's something, like, it's an absolute?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Ombuds Office, but my understanding is she's not employed by the institution, she's not under the duty to report.
Got it.
And so, so that's good. It's a very safe place to go. The downside, if you will, is that she also doesn't have an effector arm.
Right.
So she can't go to, if someone works at Brigham and Women's Hospital or Mass General Hospital, goes to her and talks about a problem, she can't go back to the leadership, even with that person's permission necessarily, and say, you should do X, Y, or Z. She's there to advise the people who come to her with concerns.
Got it.
And she's a phenomenal advisor, really phenomenal, and, you know, great deal of expertise and good at strategizing, helping people negotiate. I'll go to the Title IX. So the Title IX is for educational institutions. So for example, again, in our example, Harvard Medical School is under Title IX. The hospital, however, is under Title VII. When we're talking about discrimination and harassment.
Okay.
So we have similar obligations, but it looks a little bit different. It's, you know, obviously a different federal act, if you will. Now, as far as either an office or a center for professionalism, as you know, some institutions have those, some don't. When I proposed starting this in 2008, we had nothing like this, and which brings me to the reason that I think it's good to have an equivalent. It doesn't have to have the same name, but the function, the gap for which the function should help us bridge, is that even though every organization has places you can report concerns, as you also know, most people don't report.
Right.
And they don't report for very good reason. They're afraid of retaliation. They are skeptical that the person or the group to whom they're reporting is going to do anything about it. And it's really the risk-benefit ratio is way out of whack for the reporter of concerns. That's how it's perceived in many organizations. I can't speak even for ours in particular, but just generally. So the usual systems, especially around harassment, even though they're set up to meet the policy regulatory mandates, they in fact don't function all that well. And for lots of reasons, not because anybody has any ill will, but just because of the reasons I told you, that the culture doesn't necessarily support people going to the groups that they're technically supposed to. So many organizations decided that they want a parallel, an integrated system where there's a safe place for people to come and say what's on their mind, and that there is a possibility, with their permission, that that the person to whom they're reporting concerns could help them, or even in a proxy for them, bring the concern forward, investigate it, make sure it's valid, and then if it is, design some interventions so that the behavior which has been of concern stops. I mean, that's what we all want. We want a safe working environment that's not just safe, but also is trustworthy, and where people feel respected and valued, and also follow the law. That's a bit of a floor, but
no, That sounds very similar to an organization that I'm a part of called Time's Up Healthcare that discusses dignified, equitable, and safe working environments.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And you know, the thing is, whatever organization we're coming from or forming or working for, like, I think people want that, right? I think the problem, and you know this, and you have a lot of expertise in this, is that the way things are set up often, that is what the culture and the systems that are set up, they don't actually support that mission. And, you know, not from any, again, poor intentions, but the reality is that because of hierarchy and vulnerability, many of our systems do not really function well to actually get behaviors changed that will support that kind of environment. And so that's why many organizations have the equivalent of these centers, where there's another way to be able to address, some preventatively, some in response to, behaviors that undermine a culture of trust and respect.
Listeners are probably now connecting the dots. I brought Joe on this program so that we could discuss a very important topic. And this is thematically in the series of professional development, personal development, of how can we better take care of ourselves. I know many, many, many women. I personally have many, many, many stories regarding inequities, gender inequities, and full-on discrimination. And I think the 2018 NASEM report supports that medicine is rampant with challenges and imperfections regarding gender harassment, sexual harassment, and inequities. And Time's Up Healthcare is a not-for-profit organization that's looking to address these. And I wanted to provide tools in our listeners' toolbox. This is not just for women, but we know it proportionally affects women. Trying to create tools in the toolbox for women to find out what is available to them, what resources they have, and actually how an office of professionalism can help them.
Well, I think one very, very basic tool is to be as educated as possible about what's going on. And I mean, I will even say that though I've been steeped in this world in terms of trying to understand, prevent, treat, what have you, these issues of unprofessionalism lapses, reading these studies, the one you reference and others, was still a shock to me to see the prevalence of this problem in our healthcare organizations. And I think we need to wake up, as we are now, to the way things are. So I think that's one important thing on an individual basis that we can do, is stay really, really educated. And then I also think, and this might sound a bit too micro or putting the responsibility on the vulnerable people, but I hope it's not heard that way, is I think we should all be trained in how to respond when things happen. And so an example, I do training in how to handle microaggressions, for example, because they're going to happen. And it's really important, and I think not just training the people who might be the targets of the microaggressions, but the bystanders, the peers, the colleagues. And part of our education and training at our hospital, and I've had the privilege of going to other places and doing some training as well, is it's our moral obligation to be there for each other and to step in and say, you know, that didn't sound right to me. So I think we need to train people. I mean, I am an educator. That's part of my background in terms of what I do. I've done in clinical medicine and also my leadership work. And I just believe if we really help people see, first of all, the extent of the problem and the way it might manifest, and give them tools to address it in their own microculture. Because I could also say to everybody who's listening, you know, you should go and you should, you know, change the whole system so that this doesn't happen, or if it does, this result will occur. And I think that's great. I just also think most of us are going to be able to influence really significantly in our own environment, whether it's in our clinic or in our division or in our private practice or what have you. I think that we can be drivers of culture change without being given a title of, you know, Queen of the Universe, which is a title I've been looking for, but weirdly, nobody's given it to me.
I think, you know, most listeners will know what is meant by aggression. Some people may not know what is meant by microaggression. Is there a way that you can explain what that term means?
Yes, it's micro meaning that it's not blatant. But it is an aggression meaning it is offensive to a certain group, to a person within a certain group, and it is usually the result of the behavior happens because of implicit bias. So, this is a really gross example, but, you know, instead of somebody, you know, pinching you, they may, you know, comment, oh, you know, you look so pretty, a microaggression to women that happens is being repeatedly addressed as the nurse or the, an assistant, when in fact you've been introduced several times as their attending or their surgeon. So again, it's not somebody saying, I'm going to do something offensive and let's see what happens, but these sort of smaller, but can be pretty, in some ways, especially accumulated, can be somewhat devastating to the targets of those microaggressions.
Yeah, and they're subtle. They're not so obvious. They're difficult to measure. They're difficult to record when you recount them. They don't sound that bad. And I actually can give two examples that I've experienced recently in the emergency department. And I think what you're saying, Joe, as well, is when you have many, 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 many microaggressions, they build up over time. And ultimately, there is data to show that this these microaggressions affect confidence, they decrease confidence, they cause increased levels of stress and anxiety, depression, and ultimately what we see, and this is an absolute and a linear pathway, but one consequence is women leave. They leave the healthcare environment. They're like, I'm done with this. I'm not going to work here anymore. One example I have is I was working a triage shift in the emergency department, and one of the family members of a patient wanted to be pushed up in line and felt that if he kept coming up and kept coming up and kept coming up, then it would happen faster and I would push his family member to the head of the line. And he actually looked at me, looked at my name tag, called me by my first name, which is a move I've seen many, many, many times. Even though I always introduce myself as Dr. Lewis, he called me by my first name and he stepped in. Like he kind of came into my personal space. He also then proceeded to tell me how important he was and what businesses he owned and what roles he had and blah, 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 blah. But I was working with a scribe. The scribe got visibly uncomfortable and didn't know what to do. I was glad to have this person witness, and I explained to the scribe that this is sort of an example of a microaggression. I'll hold on my second example. I think you understand, and the listeners certainly understand this example of the subtlety, but yet it's there. And as women, we often say, did that just happen? Did I imagine that? And it's real and it's pervasive in the healthcare environment.
Yes. And as you said, it is the accumulation. You know, if somebody did that to you once every 10 years, I don't even think it would register, right? But because these things happen repeatedly, they really do start to erode, as you said, confidence and you know, have some really negative effects on people's careers. I just want to stop about for a second and just talk about culture. Sure. So culture is, this is a definition from a colleague of mine, Tony Sukman, who's a wonderful internist. A definition of culture is the patterns of relating that persist and change through ongoing interactions in our organization. So the culture isn't anything written down. It's certainly not explicit, but it is a powerful driver of outcomes. And we know that from a safety culture, the whole safety world knows that. And that's why we're working towards a just culture, psychological safety, all those sorts of things. So culture is a huge driver. And yet, it's not written down. And so we can change it. And I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna about this, but I really do believe when, as a community in medicine, that we decide we're going to change what's acceptable and what isn't, it will change. Now, that said, I also know that it's not like everybody is going to be able to speak up, because I recognize, and this is part of the reason a lot of places, you know, want to have a place that you can go that you feel safe from retaliation. A lot of people who are subject to harassment are not in a safe position to be the changers to make it stop, and they need our help. So I think the first level of help, yeah, is your colleagues. And, you know, now they may feel too vulnerable too, but if they don't, if they say, you know, to the person or people who are behaving in a way that's harassing or, you know, microaggressions, is to say, this is not okay. That is going to be extremely powerful. Can you imagine in that situation that you talked about in the ED, if a colleague of yours had said, I just want to explain to you that, you know, Dr. Lewis here is in charge of your care, and, you know, was an upstander, which is what, you know, instead of a bystander, but a real upstander, how powerful that would have been. Yes, you can stand up too, but maybe you wouldn't have been in the position where you could push back, if you will, rhetorically. And so I think we need each other to do that. And then I think we have to, and we also need to think of, what are the systems? How is the structure supporting a certain culture that we don't want anymore? And, you know, those are more, that's a different set of ways in to make changes, is looking at the systems.
I was going to say that I think you and I both recognize that we're in positions of privilege, and it's very easy if you have less to lose or if you're in this position of power, position of privilege, to speak up. So my speaking up now is very different than what my speaking up or lack of speaking up looked like 20 years ago. The second example that I wasn't going to share, that I'll just say quickly, we had a patient in the emergency department the other day. The way I conducted myself, the way I was speaking to the patient, he did not misbehave towards me. But so he was calling me as I requested, you know, Dr. Lewis, and he called the nurse hun. And I called him out and I said that I don't want you to call her that. She is a professional and you should refer to her by the name that she asked you to. And he then corrected his behavior. So I think, I don't bring these up to look what I did. It is like, we do have a voice. And part of what it sounds like the training you do is, how do you speak up? How do you handle those situations? How do you assist, amplify, help, create safety for those that don't feel that?
Exactly. Yes. And these are learnable skills. They really are. And I think to expect people on the fly to just, you know, handle a microaggression and, you know, with poise and what have you, it's unreasonable. I mean, it's very awkward, and there's risk taking, et cetera. And there's got to be, I do believe, you know, the training will help. And I actually think, I can't quote the article, but I think there's some people who look at the efficacy of training have noticed that, that it's more effective to actually train bystanders, if you will, or train us all as potential bystanders, than it is of, you know, telling people in some ways than teaching the bad behaviors to change their behavior. Because and my experience has been, the people behaving badly are usually wholly unaware of the impact of their behavior. They probably know what they're doing, but I think many times, this is not 100%, but many times they really don't know how bad it feels to the person to their target, if you will. And they need to know. They also need to know. Yeah. And this goes to the accountability, that it's not okay that we in whatever, you know, cultures, we will not accept that behavior, whether they get it, you know, or not, have insight or not, that it's not okay.
Joe, I'm going to bring our conversation to a close momentarily. I want to ask one more question, and that is, for our listeners that don't have access, don't have an office of professionalism, they aren't at a large academic institution, they actually maybe feel that they have no place to go, no one to go to, what could you offer as potential resources?
It's a good question, because as I said, you know, every healthcare organization is different and is structured differently. One is to figure out what is available. So sometimes even if it doesn't have a certain label on it, there still are resources within the organization of people that you might trust, go to for advice. For example, an ombuds person, again, even if that person doesn't have an effector arm, can actually help you strategize. So I think, you know, one strategy is to see what resources are in your organization. And then for many people don't work in large organizations, one of the most helpful things for me personally, but I think for, you know, for many others as well, is developing a community of people who, they call it in the business world, you know, your board of directors, but not literally, but your people that you can call and say, you know, this just right. happened. Can I have a reality check here? I'm feeling pretty bad. Am I off base on this, or what would you do? And I got to say, I think, you know, in my life, in my personal professional development, I got trained through this group called Leading Organizations to Health, part of that was developing this unbelievably solid and supportive community of peers who are good at peer coaching. But I think any equivalent of that, where you have people that you respect, mm-hmm. Who can help you. And then also there are people around, you know, the country who you can even reach out to, who are in positions where they're either dealing with this or have some expertise, who you can say, you know, are there other resources way outside of my institution that might be helpful to me? So I get, you know, I'm big on sharing responsibility, and also, you know, asking for help, getting help, and also giving it to others. That's why I think you and I are part of our motivation in doing this is, as you said, I'm in a position of privilege, and I can be helpful to others, and I'm happy to do that. You know, that's a joy for me to do.
That's great. So listeners, what I'm hearing from Dr. Joe Shapiro is, number one, we can educate ourselves. We can read the literature. We can find out what is the state of medicine, the state of healthcare, and the environment. Learn about microaggressions, learn about experiences you've had, and that there's actually a name that you can put to it. It's not something in your head. It's not something you've imagined. Find out locally your work environment, what's available in terms of resources, in terms of ombuds, in terms of office of professionalism. Finally, create your personal board of directors. And I'm a huge advocate of this. I consult my personal board of directors all the time for personal, professional. It's fantastic. And you connect with people that you really respect, you really love, you really trust, and they feel the same way about you. So, Joe, I really want to appreciate you and appreciate the time you've taken out of your busy day in Boston to speak with us, to speak with our listeners. Any final words that you'd like to share?
Yes, I want to actually commend your leading these conversations and creating the space for us to have them as a community. I think that working this out by sharing knowledge, experience, and strategy is so helpful. So I'm really honored to have these conversations with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, listeners, and until we speak again.